Good morning. We are in the midst of a class on Christian ethics. And I'm taking a little bit of a different slant on that whole subject by not just starting with issues and then talking about what's right and what's wrong, what's appropriate, what isn't, but rather framing ethical issues in some broader categories. And when it comes to family values, which I think is probably a good category that includes a whole lot of things, you can't avoid, and you must almost start with, sexual ethics. Because families basically have to do with men and women coming together. And that involves sexual relationships. One of the first institutions that God initiates in the creation narrative is the union of man and a wife, man and woman together, and the starting of a family, procreation, and of leaving and cleaving, that is, leaving as children grow older and starting their own families. So there's a sense in which family is really a big theme in Scripture. We talked about last week the fact that God describes Himself as Father, and that the Old Testament really is a story of a family. It's Abraham's family. The New Testament is a story of a spiritual family. It's Christ's family, spiritually. We're called brothers and sisters in the faith. We are children of God. Christ is the bridegroom to the church, which is the bride. There's this family motif that is woven through the whole theme of our theology. The subtopic is divorce and remarriage. This is a topic that is not terribly difficult to talk about, very difficult to apply pastorally. As a pastor, there are no greater challenges than dealing with marriage, divorce, and remarriage in terms of knowing what to do and how to basically respect what Scripture says, at the same time really respect the foibles of our own frailty and our mistakes, and do justice to so many different parties that have passionate competing interests. There have been many times as a pastor when I just wanted to say, I hope the rapture comes before I have to make a decision about this issue. That's very difficult. Here's part of the reason. When we look at the teaching of Jesus, it's boiled down basically to what he says in Matthew chapter 5. It was said, he's speaking now to the Jewish leaders, whoever sends his wife away, that is, divorces her, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except for reasons of unchastity, we'll talk about that in a little bit, makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Period. That is the first thing he says about it. Now, he's going to explain in chapter 19 in more detail what this means. It starts with an assumption. A Jewish woman who is divorced from her husband would marry another or have no identity in the community. The idea of a single woman in ancient Near East virtually didn't exist. A single woman outside of marriage. You were either in a home under the care of a father, or you were in a home as someone else's wife. So when it says here that the one who divorces his wife puts his wife out, he forces her into a situation where she's probably going to be married to someone else and commit adultery. The idea of her remaining single, as it is popular in our day, did not really exist in that day, unless you wanted to be a prostitute, for example. The assertion. But by doing so, that is, when she marries, she commits adultery. And the one who marries her commits adultery, is the point Jesus is making, that violates the law. The advice, lawful marriage is for life.
If there is divorce from man's standpoint, it does not terminate the marriage from God's standpoint. Therefore, remarriage is adulterous. Annulment is the only exception. We'll talk about that in a little bit as well. And this explains why in the Roman Catholic Church and for much of the Church's history, annulment was such a big deal, because it basically described a marriage as unlawful and therefore never having taken place. In Romans chapter 12, we have a passage that you've seen often in classes where I've been teaching and others have taught as well. This passage summarizes a great deal of what the New Testament teaching of Paul is all about. I urge you therefore, brethren, Paul says, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. A number of observations we can make here. Our bodies, that is, our sensual passions, must be submitted to our spiritual service if we are to follow Christ. When he talks about our bodies here, I believe what he's touching on is our sensual passions, including our sexual appetites. He's saying, basically, you've got to bring your appetites under control if you're going to follow Christ. And what that's going to mean is it starts in your mind. How you perceive the passions of your body in regard to God's purposes in life. And it's going to involve, a mind that is changed or sees things differently. It's hard for us to see the issue of divorce and remarriage in the same way the church has seen it for three-fourths of its history. Most of us have grown up in a culture that is so radically different than the perspective that existed before the turn of the century that it's hard for us to imagine it. Most of us have little appreciation for how dramatically the Protestant Reformation and the Enlightenment have changed our culture, our perceptions, and our expectations. And in terms of being conformed to this world, I believe what Paul is talking about in terms of its application to our culture has to do with appreciating the dramatic way in which the Reformation and the Enlightenment have changed our culture. We can look at it this way. I'm going to take a moment to frame this change to appreciate what Jesus and later next week what Paul is thinking. I was going to do this all in one session. We can't do that. We're going to do this week, and next week we'll look at Paul's teaching and more of the application of it all. The Dark Ages, which basically are described by historians as the period between 500 and 1500 AD in Western civilization, basically was broken by the Renaissance and the Protestant Reformation. The Protestant Reformation was basically the opening of the doors to a whole new way of seeing life. The fact is, however, that until the Protestant Reformation, the Church had a view of human sexuality that was really quite dark. And I'm not suggesting this is true of the initial teaching of the New Testament, but until you get to the Reformation, what we see here is a very negative attitude toward human sexuality. And to a large extent, it was an overreaction to pagan excesses. Sensual immorality, gluttony, irrationality, so forth and so on. And the Reformation basically put a stop to a lot of that. A lot of this was fueled by dualism, the idea that the flesh or the material is bad, the spirit, the spiritual life, is good. So if you want to be spiritual, anything that has to do with the flesh, you basically suppress and repress, including your appetites, and especially your pleasures, the things that excite the passions of the flesh. And asceticism, that is, the monastic way of life, where you withdraw from physical comforts and basically concentrate on the development of the spiritual side of life. Now, what this looked like was, what we're going to see in a moment, is pretty ugly picture of human sexuality. And it was justified, as most movements in the history of the church have been justified, by finding a text of Scripture that will support it. And the text that was often used was 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. It is good for a man not to touch a woman, Paul says. Now you put that in context, and it seems a little differently. But out of this context, it can be read as though human sexuality is something that is a threat to our spirituality and should be shut down as much as possible. This is basically what some call the dark ages of sexuality in terms of church history. All sexual pleasure is sinful, even in marriage. You can have sexual intercourse for the procreation of children, but you better not enjoy it. And if you do, confess it as sin. Celibacy is glorified. In other words, the real life of dedication is to be celibate. Sex was for procreation only. And romantic love is to be replaced with agape love, or mature love. Yes, you're called to love your wife, but don't let it be a sensual love. Let it be a caring, godly love, agape love. Yes?
What was the original context of that verse?
Of what verse?
The one,
we'll get to it next week.
Oh.
Next week we'll talk about Paul's teaching in chapter 7 of Romans. And part of your assignment, if you follow the assignments the reading before the class next week, you'll be reading 1 Corinthians chapter 7, the whole chapter. It'll give you a context for that. The Enlightenment, however, which basically was spawned by the Protestant Reformation in some respects, and Romanticism and modernity that came out of that, gave to us, along with many good things, a lot of things that became potentially threatening to the Christian Church. For example, human rights and individual freedom. Individual freedom and human rights basically spawned democratic government. And they spawned virtually the core of what we enjoy as the sore heart and soul of Western civilization, America, to a certain extent. But there's a sense in which human freedom, basically, when it's basically brought to apply to our individual lives, it has to do with, to a large extent, my fulfillment. I am free to fulfill myself by expressing myself, by taking responsibility for myself, so forth and so on. And we have here then human rights and my fulfillment competing with one another. You have rights, I have a responsibility to be fulfilled in terms of expressing myself, being true to myself, so to speak. These things often will conflict. And that creates a problem for human beings and for computers. Okay. And that competition between your rights and my fulfillment creates a real problem, a real point of tension. Let me explain or illustrate what I mean by that. In ancient culture, in the ancient Mideast, Canaanite culture had a practice of sacrificing children to the god Moloch. The sacrifice of children in Canaan to Moloch was probably the height of debauchery with respect to pagan religion. What we don't realize is that is expressed today not in terms of overt sacrifice, but some commentators have noted that what we're doing now is the same thing. Through divorce and abortion, we basically are sacrificing our children at the altar of my personal fulfillment. What I mean by that is this. When I have a child that I don't want that's coming, it's going to interrupt my sense of fulfillment, I abandon the family or I abort the child. I've got that way out. If I'm in a relationship maritally that doesn't satisfy me or fulfill me, blocks my goals and achievement, I get a divorce and find another relationship that will work better. In both cases, children are the ones who bear the burden. And especially with respect to divorce. You don't think of divorce as being so hard on children, perhaps, whereas abortion is obvious. If you recognize that the unborn is a child, a person with rights. But divorce is devastating to children, statistically. Not every child of divorce is a basket case. But statistically, the differences are not obscure, or they're not hard to detect. Princess Diana captured it well with these words, and here reflecting on the fact that the man who married her told her child, "I never loved your mother," and she says, "What must it be like for a little boy to read that Daddy never loved Mommy?" And I think anyone who's been through a situation of divorce, I've been very fortunate, I have not, but there are members of my family that have gone through this, and I have close friends who have gone through this. What happens when you look inside the soul of a child is a deep woundedness that is hard to work around. Research comparing children of divorced parents to children with married parents shows the following things. 40% of all children experience a breakup of their biological parents. 40%, that's alarming. Children from divorced homes suffer academically. They experience high levels of behavioral problems. Their grades suffer. And they are less likely to graduate from high school. Kids whose parents divorce are substantially more likely to be incarcerated for committing crimes, and especially as juveniles. Because the custodial parents' income drops substantially after divorce, children in divorced homes are almost five times more likely to live in poverty than children from intact married parents. Teens from divorced homes are much more likely to engage in drug and alcohol use as well as premarital sex than those in intact marriages. Children from divorced homes are more likely to divorce themselves when they become married. This is something that is tragic. If you come from a divorced home, statistically your chances of being divorced are much greater. Children from divorced homes have increased incidence of physical illnesses and recover from those sicknesses more slowly. They're more likely to suffer abuse. And children of divorced parents suffer more frequently from symptoms of psychological distress. And the emotional scars of divorce oftentimes last for a very long time. Now again, I'm not suggesting that everyone who's grown up in a divorced family is going to be a wreck. That's not true. There are many wonderful exceptions to this. But statistically, these are facts.
Jim?
Yes?
In your reading, did you find anything that compared a divorced couple and the children with a couple that stays together for the sake of the children? You know, you hear that all the time. They're going to stay together. They don't love each other.
Right.
But for the sake of the children, what about those children?
And especially when there's abuse in that family.
Right. Dr. Phil, I think, hits it on the head. He says, being in a divorced family is no better than being from a divorced family. That is, being in a broken family is no better than being from a broken family. A broken family injures children, whether you're in it or from it. Again, it's the brokenness of the family that is the issue. Yes, Dorothy.
Just a little story. A good friend of mine, his husband died after 2 years of very severe lung cancer. She had three children, and they were at the funeral. When they came home, and immediately after the funeral, the 13-year-old says to his mother, "Mom, it could have been worse." And my friend looks at him and says, "Well, Ian, what on earth do you mean?" He says, "Well, you know, you could have divorced Dad."
Mm.
And my friend then said to me, "You know what he's telling me? he's telling me actually that he would rather see his father dead than divorced.
Yeah. I think it is. Children have a way of blaming themselves. When they desperately, growing up, they desperately want to know they are affirmed by their parents, the authority figures in their life. And when they see their parents decide to divorce, they say, why wasn't I enough to keep them together? Why was it not enough for them to notice that I needed their love, for they would stick together? Children have a way of doing their math psychologically in such a way that they take responsibility for parents' divorce. Now, again, as we're going to see next week, sometimes damage control is needed. Sometimes there has to be a separation. But it's never the kind of thing that's good. There's always collateral damage with this.
Jim, will you address what the effect is of adult children?
Well, the question is, what about adult children? The sad fact is, a lot of the problems and injuries and soul sorrow of a child is carried into adulthood. And there are some people, not everyone, but there are some people who carry that with them throughout their life.
No, I'm saying, what if the children are already adults when the parents live?
Oh, okay. It's less traumatic, usually. Because the more independent a child comes from the parents, the more they gain their energy outside their relationship with their parents, the more insulation they have from severe injuries. But the young children that really bear the brunt of that.
Probably already broken this going on before that anyhow. It's just, children are, it's like being in versus being from.
Right.
If parents decide to divorce later.
Yeah, it's very seldom that the divorce comes out of the blue. It's usually the result of dysfunction other places. That is, being from a broken family before you're, or being in a broken family before you're from a broken family. It's just not a pretty thing. The point I want to make is this, apart from the details. This is the sacrifice of children. A divorce, we've got to understand, but a divorce sacrifices children. It's a subtle, slow form of torturing a child. And I think we've got to understand that. So when we talk about when we look at Jesus' teaching on divorce and Paul's teaching on divorce and why they take this so seriously, I think we've got to keep that in mind. The financial cost of divorce is dramatic. The average divorce only costs $15,000 or $30,000. However, the settlements can be ridiculous. Now, not everyone is Madonna. Madonna settled for $75 million. But Rupert Murdoch, $1.7 billion. That's quite a settlement. But of course, he may have never missed that. 28% of children from broken homes will live in poverty, as opposed to the national average of 17%. 27% of divorced women will live in poverty, as opposed to the national average of 13%. The greatest contribution to poverty in the mind of some sociologists is the broken family. Psychologically, guilt and shame can be deep, and they can persist for a long time, even into adulthood. There are some people I know in this room who bear that burden. I have relatives who are adults and still cannot talk about the pain of divorce. And socially, the effect on children can be severe and lifelong, but nearly every area of social life is affected. And usually in a negative way. And it's not just the children. It's the people who go through the divorce are affected. All of a sudden, you discover the church is designed for couples only when you're a divorced person. All of a sudden, your friends change. You don't have... Everything's designed for couples, it seems. And there's a sense in which you have to have new friends because the old friends are no longer fitting into, or you're no longer fitting into to their social framework. Just a whole lot of things that are just extremely painful that people don't really realize when they're contemplating divorce. And spiritually, sense of isolation, guilt, lack of confidence and so forth. There are exceptions to this, but I have yet to meet someone who's gone through a divorce who doesn't feel great guilt, no matter how innocent they were in the process. The fact that my husband left me or my wife left me, even though I tried everything I knew to keep them together, I feel guilty because I chose this marriage. I got into this marriage. Why couldn't I have seen that before? There's this nagging sense of shame and guilt that comes with this that people who have never gone through this oftentimes don't realize or appreciate. Divorce in the U.S., this is what the statistics look like. Americans continue to have the highest divorce rate of any industrial nation. That has been a fact for a long period of time. Although you'll notice the divorce rates are going down. I'll explain that in just a little bit. If you look at the way in which our society has treated divorce legally, it went from before 1850, divorce was restricted to adultery, desertion, or physical abuse. From 1850 to 1960, it was based also on mental cruelty. And then in 1970, beginning in 1960, really, it was based upon irreconcilable differences. In other words, we just are tired of one another. You know, when we want to get out. And that became, that brought in this landslide of divorce. But the decline of divorce is deceiving because it's explained in part by the decline of marriage rates. If you chart this against marriage rates over the same period of time, marriage rates are going down. And as a result, divorces go down. Why are marriage rates going down? Because more people are living together and bearing children out of wedlock. You no longer be married to have children. The number of children born out of wedlock has gone up. And the number of couples living together outside of marriage has increased dramatically. So that now you have people who don't need marriage. As a matter of fact, when you read the reports of sociological studies, you find that marriage now becomes kind of a token. It's the kind of thing people want aesthetically, but not necessarily, they don't need it legally. They don't need it in terms of having a sexual relationship with someone. They just want it as kind of a decoration, in a sense, to celebrate their lives. Yes?
What's that spike after World War II?
That was husbands being gone and coming home and marriage is not working.
Huh.
There's the great insult of war on the human race is not small.
Combat changes you.
Yeah, combat changes you. And distance changes you. But that's the explanation of the spike after the World War. Explanations of why divorce is this way. Our culture has become a more me-centered culture. It's my happiness. It's me now and my way. How do I expect it to satisfy me? Well, I want health, first of all. I want close friends. I want financial freedom. I want to be moderately prosperous. And I want to have a fulfilling job that uses my gifts and rewards me. But the big things are marriage and the family. I want to experience in a relationship with my wife or my husband, deep sense of emotional fulfillment. I want in my family someone I can be, or people I can be proud of. I want the joy of the white picket fence and children going to college and going to high school ball games, so forth and so on, having this idealistic family. Problem is, when this doesn't work, when I'm not happy, I can bail out and divorce, or if children get in the way, I abort or abandon. And again, this is a tug of war between my fulfillment, me now and my way, and the realities of the things that I hope to be fulfilling. When they're not, I basically discard them. And in the process, basically, we have a modern form of child sacrifice. And we can laugh and cry at Moloch sacrifice. We need to have the same deep tear in our eye, in our heart, for what's happening to children as a result of a me generation, where everything, especially marriage and the family, is all about my fulfillment. If we embrace that, if we are conformed to the world in that respect, if we are not renewed in our minds, if we do not see the presenting of our bodies as a living sacrifice, as our passions as a living sacrifice, if we don't take that step, following Christ is going to be at least confusing and at most cruel, because it robs us of the source of hope that we have for personal fulfillment. And I think we've got to understand, when we look at this, the teaching of Scripture on divorce and remarriage, we've got to understand, this is the way the Scripture frames the battleground. This is the way in which God sees the human dilemma. And it's radically different from the way in which a post-enlightened culture sees it. Now, we like to think that Christians, basically, being a Christian makes a big difference in terms of divorce and remarriage. It does not. If you look at the statistics in terms of the religious responses to divorce trends, if a national population is 33%, that is, marriages take place today, one-third of them are probably not going to last. You say, why is this different than 45, which is the national average? It's because we don't calculate here multiple marriages. That is marriage, divorce. There are many people who have been married several times. When you look at various groups in terms of their divorce rate, those that fare the best are the atheists and agnostics. Those who fare the worst are the conservative Christians. Raw facts, yes.
On a religious news site, that when you actually factor in not just what you are, Southern Baptist or whatever, but factor in how frequently you go to church, participate in small group Bible studies, and so forth, that the numbers actually look a little better than what that chart says.
Yes, yes. Yeah, there are lots of ways which you categorize this. But by and large, sociologists would say that conservative Christians fare at least as bad, if not worse, than the national average. And they offer an explanation for this that makes sense. One, conservatives may have higher rates of divorce because they have more unrealistic expectations of marriage, and because they tend to apply gender roles in abusive ways. In other words, if I go into marriage, as we're going to explain in a little bit, with the expectation that if I pray to God that He will lead me to marry the right person, and I'm convinced that He has led me and my wife or my husband to be married, we go into marriage with this expectation that this is a marriage made in heaven. It's God's will. All of a sudden, He's abusing me. All of a sudden, He's running around on me. How can this be? And the sense of disillusionment that comes from having these high expectations of this marriage being made in heaven, being a soulmate given to me by God, all of a sudden that crashes and burns. And the tolerance for going through that difficult time is, in the case of those who have those expectations, very small, very short.
Is that due to the person's perspective on God?
Yes, it has to do with, I think, a misunderstanding of what marriage is supposed to be, where all of a sudden marriage has a messianic role in my life. I get married expecting that God is going to lead me to a place where marriage is going to fulfill all of my emotional, social needs. And when it doesn't, basically I have no tolerance for navigating a marriage that's not going to do that. Because God obviously wants me to be happy.
And does that person feel like God let them down or God failed them?
Well, usually they'll say, I chose the wrong person. I just need to get a person that's going to make it work. Yes.
Yeah. Non-denominational marriages, do they occur earlier and therefore are less stable?
That's a good point. That's another very good point, Gunter, that non-denominational or conservative marriages tend to take place earlier. You have younger people marrying than the national average. That is true. Yes.
Did you ever see any data on the Mormons? Because they believe that marriage is made in heaven and it's for eternity.
that Mormons are humans.
Okay, so there's no difference?
Well, it's right here.
Oh. Oh, okay.
They do quite well.
Sorry, I missed it.
Yeah. You got to read the notes here, Charles. The second myth. Christians' view of marriage is too low and their expectations of marriage is too high. Four common myths. Marriage is designed for my fulfillment. Lots of Christians, lots of churches even teach this. Now, there's a certain amount of truth in this. Adam was alone. And this narrative in Genesis says that God created a helpmeet for him, that he would not be alone. There's a sense in which intimate connectedness and fulfillment is to be expected. That's a part of God's plan. But God never intended Adam's wife to become his Messiah, to have a messianic role in his life, and vice versa. Marriage is expected to meet my emotional needs. I shouldn't ever be lonely again. One of the greatest insurance policies a person can make for their marriage is be a part of a broader Christian community, loving community, where you have several close friends, not intimate sexual friends, but where you have several people who basically have an impact into your life emotionally and socially, and just charge your battery in ways in which your family should also. But it's not just your family. You're a part of a bigger family now, the family of God. When Jesus, on the going to the cross, is challenged with identifying his family, he doesn't look at his biological family. He says, those who believe are my family. These are my family. The third thing, finding God's will for the right person will secure a successful marriage. We prayed about it. God led us. We are convinced this is God's will. When that happens, I always want to say, tell me exactly how you know this is God's will. I want to know the details. Well, we just feel it. That's not going to do. You can feel a whole lot of things. There are a lot of people who have felt God's will and done crazy things. You don't marry a person because you basically have a feeling that this is the right person. Zsa-Zsa Gabor, who basically should know something about marriage, married 9 times and divorced 9 times. She said, it's just as foolish to marry a person to divorce a person because you no longer love them as it is to marry a person because you do love them. In other words, she said, the reason for marriage is more than just a feeling of love, or it should be. She finally learned that after 9 marriages. Christian marriage comes with a guarantee. We are Christians. We are a trinity. It's my wife, myself, and God. And we have life insurance, marriage insurance with that. Good luck. Now, am I saying that God doesn't make a difference? He certainly makes a difference in our lives and therefore in our marriages. But if we think that just because we have a relationship with God, we are guaranteed a happy marriage, wake up. There are a lot of very good marriages that aren't Christian. And there are many Christian marriages that are really in trouble. The factors that make for a marriage are not primarily, are you a Christian or are you not? And when we believe that, when we expect that because we are Christians, we're going to have a buy. We're going to have a get-out-of-jail-free card in terms of relationships, including marriage. We're kidding ourselves. Marriage is difficult. It requires deep commitment. It boils down to 3 things, more than that, really, but 3 things that in my experience. One is your personal maturity level, your willingness to take responsibilities for your decisions, your faith commitment, your commitment to covenant of marriage, being faithful to a covenant, being willing to go through the hard times as well as the good times. The third one was what from last week? I forgot. I'll get to it in a little bit. There's a third one too. But I'm getting too old to remember those things. But the point is this. These things are false hopes. And when we set ourselves up with these things, we set ourselves up for the possibility of bailing out when it doesn't pay off. Here's a good example. This is not a Christian. This is a writer whose quote, I think, however, nails our culture. We ruined each other by being together. We destroyed each other's dreams. So sad. We are divorcing because we ruined each other by being together. We destroyed each other's dreams. You know, marriage is to basically fulfill my dreams and your dreams. And if it doesn't, get the blank out of Dodge. That's basically the attitude of our culture. That's the spirit of our age. Being not conformed to the world is right here. This is it. And yet many Christians come with that testimony. You know, being together, I just can't fulfill my dreams. And furthermore, I'm destroying his dreams or her dreams the same way. And we have to ask ourselves, so what? If your dreams basically exclude the building and giving of yourself to this person, to this marriage, then you've got a problem. Explanation number 3. Failure to view marriage as ministry. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21, the passage we looked at last week, Paul starts by saying, be subject to one another in the fear of Christ. Being subject to one another means that marriage requires an expectation of serving rather than being served. I mentioned Larry Crabb's book last week, which I'll push again this week. It's not the only good book, but it's one. Where he says basically this, in a healthy marriage, I minister to my mate, and I don't manipulate them to fulfill my selfish agenda. And he says basically marriages consist basically of ministry or manipulation. And sometimes push and shove of both. We are either manipulating our mate to make us happy, fulfill us, or we're committing ourselves to make the life of our mate mature and fulfilled. A healthy marriage basically commits itself at the altar and before to ministry, not to manipulate. Harry Sullivan nails love with this definition. When the satisfaction, security, and development of another person is as important to you as your own satisfaction, security, and development, love exists. Another way of saying something very similar would be this. When we work as hard at understanding our mate as we do at being understood by them, we understand more than each other. We understand love. Love basically means that I dedicate myself to understand and serve my mate, not to be understood and served by them. Now, that sounds very simple. Obvious. Who's going to disagree with that? But for many of us, that's not the way we operate. And it's not the way in which we are encouraged to operate, even in our Christian communities. Now, what does the Bible say? We're finally getting to the Scripture now. We've got 5 minutes. There are 4 basic texts in Scripture that deal with this subject. Many more, but these are basic texts. Genesis 24, Deuteronomy 24, or Genesis 2, Deuteronomy 24, Matthew chapter 5, chapter 5, and 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And chapter 19 of Matthew as well. Genesis 2:24. Then God said, this is the creation narrative, it is not good for man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him. Verse 24. For this reason the man shall leave his father and mother and shall join his wife to his wife, be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Marriage here is universal. It's before the fall. It's basically before the promise given to Abraham. It's before the advent of Christ. Marriage is something that is a universal characteristic of human beings in God's plan. Its purpose is to bear the image of God. In chapter 1, he says this, we are made in the image of God, male and female. Procreation, to multiply and fill the earth. And personal fulfillment, man was not to be alone. But those 3 things at least are the purpose of marriage. And marriage is family-centered. It's moving from one family and starting another. and it's gender specific. A suitable helper was the opposite sex. If there's an argument scripturally against homosexual marriage, this is it right here. What is suitable for Adam? Not Steve, but Eve. And that is the way in which the narrative of marriage starts. Now again, the homosexual marriage issue is complicated. We'll get to that down the road. But I think from the very beginning, what's suitable for Adam is Eve. Deuteronomy 24. Moses basically has this instruction, and this instruction is picked up by Jesus, but it's important for us to note it before we get there. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, then there are instructions. For example, if someone else marries her, he says, and that person dies, she can't go back to the first husband. It's a lot of complicated rules that go with the Mosaic Code. But the point for our purposes here is to recognize that Moses recognized a certificate of divorcement for some reason. The fact that divorce was permitted, I think it here is described as opposed to prescribed. Moses is not saying you must divorce. He's saying divorce is permitted. It takes place. And it was unclear for the rabbis in Jesus' day as to just exactly what this some indecency referred to. Those who followed Rabbi Hillel and Shammai had different opinions about this. Some indecency for the followers of Hillel was something to the effect that just about any reason would do. If she didn't cook the bagels right, she could be out. For Shammai, it was sexual offenses only. And usually, it was not necessarily adultery, but basically being unfaithful during the betrothal period. In Matthew chapter 19, Paul explains this text. He refers to it. Or Jesus does, excuse me. And this is the passage. And some Pharisees came to him, that is Jesus, testing him, saying, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause at all? Again, the Hillel Shammai dispute. And he answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Consequently, they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. Period. Then they asked another question. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? He said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it has not been this way. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. And the disciples said to him, if the relationship of a man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry. Now, the explanation of the significance of what Jesus is saying here is captured in this last expression of the disciples. They're saying, if marriage is this permanent, who wants to take the risk of marrying if you can't get out? This suggests that they understood Jesus' teaching to be very strict, stricter than Hillel or Shammai would have allowed. Now, let's go back and look at this passage. And the first verses 8 and following. Two significant words. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality, those two words are key. Jesus looked at Genesis 2 as being the foundation for marriage, not Deuteronomy 24, first of all. And he concentrates on these words. The covenant community, of course, is what he's talking about. He's not talking about mixed marriages. We'll get to that next week. That is, marriage between a believer and an unbeliever. But he respects your damage control. Because of the hardness of your heart, sometimes you don't have good choices. You've got two bad choices. and you can limit the damage with a divorce. And of course, that's a lot of what we face today. Divorce is the word used in Matthew chapter 1 of Joseph's plan for Mary. In other words, he's Joseph, you remember, the father of Jesus, in a social sense, is betrothed to Mary. Betrothal period in ancient Israel was a year of waiting to test the virtue of the bride. And during that period, if she was found to be unfaithful, could not be a virgin, then he could divorce her and not fall through on the marriage. If she remained faithful or was faithful, then the marriage could proceed. In the case of Jesus' birth, she was pregnant, and Joseph basically had the right to divorce her, even though they had not technically consummated their marriage. And he chose not to do that. The word used there in terms of her situation was the word that is used here in terms of divorce. It was basically to put her away in the sense of the betrothal breach. The meaning of immorality, the second word, I think also is important. It's not the normal word for adultery. There's a word, a Hebrew word for adultery. It's not used here. This is the word that is used only in Matthew's accounts. Mark and Luke say the same, have the same teaching. They just use a different word, or they don't use porneia or the exception clause here. Only Matthew uses this. It is implied in Jesus' birth when in John chapter 8, the Pharisees mock Jesus by saying, "At least we are not children of porneia, or children of fornication." In other words, the idea was, this person was illegitimate. Jesus was illegitimate, and we do not basically have to bow down to an illegitimate person. That was their argument. But again, they're referring to the betrothal period. And in Matthew chapter 15, the word is used alongside adultery and distinct from it. The point is this. Jesus here is referring, most likely, not to adultery in a marriage relationship, but rather to the breaking of the betrothal vow that was unique to Jewish culture. And that's the way a growing number of scholars are looking at this passage. Which means that there is no exception clause to marriage in Jesus' teaching, except for an illegitimate marriage in the first place. And this is consistent with what we read in the Old Testament generally. When Nehemiah and Ezra cleanse the temple, the first thing they do is they dissolve all of the mixed marriages. They declared them annulled. And I think the same thing as we're going to see in Paul's writing, he picks up on this. What do you do when you have a mixed marriage? If the, as he's going to say, if the unbeliever chooses to leave, let them leave. You are free then. But you are not free to basically initiate the divorce. We'll talk about that next week. If you're going to quit in a marriage, again, quoting my mentor, Dr. Phil, you must earn the right to quit because you did everything you could to save the relationship. Now, there are a number of things he says that I think are spot on. I don't agree with him on everything, but here he is right. He recognizes divorce sometimes is necessary. Not necessarily God's will, ideally, but it's necessary. But before you get to the place where you pull that trigger, you've got to earn the right to do it. And that is where you've got to fight for your marriage and for the relationship. 10 top reasons people don't last, or marriages don't last. People do last, marriages don't. 1, cohabitation. If you live together before you're married, statistically, you're going to have a higher rate of divorce. Fathers. Absentee fathers put daughters at risk. This is why, to a large extent, in the African-American community, divorce is rampant, because the fathers are absent. Poverty. Economic changes. Women in the workplace. Nothing wrong with that. But when roles become confused, and when especially men are unemployed, they tend to leave for shame and other reasons, this damages relationships and increases divorce. Parents. If your parents have been divorced, the likelihood of you experiencing divorce goes up. Legislation. When divorce becomes no fault, when it's easy, there are no social restrictions against it. Differences. Unshared values and different cultures increase the likelihood of divorce. Getting divorced for the wrong reason, the wrong rationale. Getting divorced because it's going to basically get back at my parents, or it's going to please my parents, or something else. And expectations. Demanding personal fulfillment. Expecting that marriage is going to solve my problems. That sets you up for a greater risk of divorce. And number two, a lack of commitment. Failing to bring self-sacrifice to marriage, but expecting it to be easy. And the number one, this is in my personal view, is immaturity. Teens getting married. Marriage is not for children, it's for adults. And you can be a teenager when you're 45. Adulthood has little to do with age. Something to do with age, but not altogether. Marriage is a lifelong covenant that is unbreakable. But then the question is, what about unlawful marriages? And what about multiple marriages? You've been married several times and divorced several times. What about damage control and abusive relationships? What about God's grace? We'll answer all those questions next week. For Christians, everything is okay in the end. If it's not okay, it's not the end. If you want the notes from this, you can get them on the website. You can understand perhaps why this is a series in itself. But next week we'll look at Paul's teaching and some of the pastoral realities of applying all of this to real life.